This is an alarm sounding in a police station somewhere in the United States. The alarm is meant for you. It's a warning to wake up, to shake loose from the grip of the nation's nightmare. The nightmare described by Senator Herbert O'Connor.
Our Senate Crime Investigating Committee has found alarming instances of syndicated crime and of unhealthy alliances with law enforcement officials. The remedy is in the hands of the people, who must act before it is too late.
The Nation's Nightmare. The CBS radio network and its affiliated stations, in cooperation with law enforcement agencies throughout the country, present by popular request a rebroadcast of its documentary series on the pattern of organized crime in America, its shape, its form, who runs it, and what can be done about it. Every voice and sound you will hear has been recorded from real life. No actors are used. Now here to report to you on the nation's nightmare is the noted CBS newsman, Bill Downs.
Organized crime does pay. It pays big. It's an industry, a business, with millions of American customers. Only they're not called customers. They're called suckers. The lifeblood of organized crime is money. The source of that money is the take from gambling. In this second program on the nation's nightmare, we look into the gambling machine, the slots, the wheels, the casinos, and the men who run them.
There you go, man. Coming right out of New Hand. New hitter. Where's the other $2? Coming right out somewhere to win. Let him out of red, man. Here they go.
Do you know that sound? It's an operator in a dice pit calling the fall in a big game of chance known as craps. The air is filled with excitement. There's $1,000 on the next roll. Everyone is gripped by the gambling fever. Everyone watches breathless for the next throw of the dice. Everyone, that is, except the dealer. He knows who's going to win. He is. But you've got to take your chances, most people say. There's the excitement, the passion of gambling. So what if you lose? It's fun, isn't it?
Sure, I gamble. Everybody gambles. I learned to gamble way back in the speakeasy days, and I've been doing it ever since. Don't you gamble?
Well, don't you gamble?
Pick them up.
Yes, we do. Whether it's the hooligan game at the Chicago bar that you hear, or the neighborhood bingo game, or the street urchins shooting craps, or the friendly game of poker, or the speculator on the stock market, or the tourist at Monte Carlo. We gamble, 50 million of us. Well, there's a hot argument about the morality of gambling, but there's no argument about this. When Frank J. Lausche became governor of Ohio in 1949, he gave orders to close down the gambling casinos. Handicapped by inadequate laws, he used the powers of the Department of Liquor Control to padlock the joints. Anthony Rutkowski, chief of the Enforcement Division, led the raid on the Jungle Inn, a plush casino near Youngstown, Ohio. He and his men were unarmed. Here's what happened.
I said, "Who is the boss?" And he pointed to a man standing in the doorway in the cashier's office and said, "That is the boss." That man later turned out to be John Farrah. Then this man that was known as John Farrah approached me and started to curse me and swear at me, using foul and indecent language. He was in a frenzy and then turned and pointed against the west wall of the building and said, "Goon, kill him, goon, kill him, shoot him." And he repeated, "Shoot him again." I then looked up at this wall, and I noticed a steel turret. That was the gun turret. One of my agents ran into the gun turret and saw a man in the gun turret who held a shotgun in his hand. And the man said to him, "I'm not going to shoot nobody. I'm not going to shoot nobody. I don't want to go to the electric chair." And just as he said that, this agent grappled with him and took the gun away from him. And here are the bullets.
Those are paper-covered shotgun shells. The basic fact of life, a fact we don't like to see, is that the big business of gambling is controlled by the underworld, usually under the cloak of legitimate enterprise. How do they get away with it? Easy. All you need are public officials, police, judges, legislators, who directly or indirectly get a cut of the gambling pay. Then you hoodwink the public into the idea that it would be bad for business if gambling were to go. Shake well and presto, you get away with it. People will believe anything. Police Chief Beauregard Miller of Gretna, Louisiana, sat on the porch of his palatial homestead and advanced this very argument. His town has been closed up tight since the Senate Crime Committee visited the area.
They are clear about gambling in Gretna. And I gladly admitted that they had it over there. And there's been gambling there ever since I know myself. There were gambling there before I was chief of police. There were gambling there during my daddy's administration. The people of Gretna went gambling. Without gambling in Gretna, we would have a ghost town. The sheriff made a statement that he wouldn't leave gambling open up again, and from all indications, it looks like he means it. But we hope someday that there'll be a new sheriff. The election comes up in January, and we're going to have a lot of fun in the political fight.
If you want the key to illegal gambling, if you want to know why it flourishes, look to the public officials. Virgil Peterson, operating director of the Chicago Crime Commission and a former FBI man, has made a lifelong study of gambling and organized crime. He can spell it out.
In virtually every large city, the pattern of protection insofar as gambling and other rackets are concerned has been exactly the same. The gambling or racketeering elements become influential politically through political contributions or through the furnishing of workers at the polls. Through this political influence, they become in a position to dictate law enforcement policies and control law enforcement officials and agencies. Whenever gambling flourishes in a wide open basis in any community, it is definitely because the officials of those communities permit it to operate openly and notoriously. And this, of course, also means corruption.
The record, the long record of collusion between gangsters and public officials is not good. One of the filthiest stories to come out of recent years was that of Charles Bonaggio, Kansas City racketeer and local Democratic Party leader. Bonaggio committed himself to the mobsters by accepting campaign contributions. When he failed to open up Kansas City for gambling, when he was rebuffed by the National Democratic Party, his time began to run out. He made a frantic last-minute attempt to bribe a member of the Kansas City Board of Police Commissioners, R. Robert Cohn. Here's the story from Mr. Cohn.
Briefly, he just told me on different occasions that he'd made certain promises and that the boys were anxious to get started and that the governor had been in office for a period of time and naturally he had to do something about it. About May 9th, 1949, the governor did get an opportunity to appoint two new members of the Board of Police Commissioners, and of course these members had the approval of Charlie Bonaggio. And it was quite necessary that he have an opportunity to get the support of a third member in order to control the situation. Efforts were made to get a new chief of police, and Charlie Bonaggio told me the reason he wanted this particular man as chief of police was because he could be handled. Of course, I refused to go along on this. I refused to go along on any changes that Charlie Bonaggio wanted because I knew it was not to the best interest of the police department or Kansas City generally. Time went on, and I was being contacted by various school friends and army buddies and whatnot who were members of the Bonaggio group until sometime the latter part of June when Bonaggio, who I had turned down on several occasions prior, but I didn't even want to see him, insisted that he must see me, and he did sit out in front of my home one evening, dark, told me that they were way behind schedule, the pressure was on, and that the boys were after him, and that it was up to me, that I was holding up the show, and that he had to go through with his program. gave the appearance of a man that was quite worried and arrest, and almost like a bolt of lightning, he threw a roll of bills at me. And I immediately turned him back to him. And he felt sorry after he threw the bills at me, but he said that he just had to do something, and he was sorry that I couldn't go along on his program.
A few weeks later, Bonaggio was found murdered in his party clubhouse. Gambling is legalized in only one state, Nevada. In other states, it operates illegally or through the use of local option laws, which allow communities and counties to decide whether there shall be gambling or not.
All set and ready to roll.
And there they go.
We went down to Las Vegas, Nevada, to see how legalized gambling operates. A big crap game was going on at Wilbur Clark's fabulous Desert Inn.
Daisy, May.
10 easy, 10.
2 weeks, 10 days.
30 for 6.
Jay Kozloff of the Golden Nugget told us about his place.
We operate the following game. 8 crap tables, 6 21 tables, 3 roulette tables, 1 chuck-a-luck, 1 big 6 wheel, racehorse keno board, 5 poker tables, 1 faro bank, 1 sports book, 1 horse book, approximately 150 slot machines, and 1 bingo parlor. Approximately 25,000 people pass through our doors every day.
Las Vegas City Attorney Howard Cannon told us about legalized gambling.
It should be pointed out that the gaming and liquor industry is operating on an open and above board basis in the state of Nevada. That it is being examined constantly by investigators for the Nevada Tax Commission, and since the creation of the Nevada Tax Commission, no one with a long criminal record has been given a license to operate gambling in the state of Nevada.
The Nevada experiment in legalized gambling has been going on for 20 years. These years have been marked by unsavory episodes like that of Bugsy Siegel, former director of Murder Incorporated, who was boss of Las Vegas gambling until his murder in California in 1947. Nevada officials claim that new restrictive licensing laws effectively take care of the gangster element. While the Senate Crime Committee unanimously agreed that conditions in Nevada are not helpful, that as a case for legalized gambling, Nevada speaks eloquently in the negative. The experience of towns and states that have tried legalization outside Nevada would appear to back this up. The flood of bad checks, the rise in petty thievery, the swelling relief rolls, the broken homes, the political corruption that follow in the wake of legalization all speak for the negative. One thing everyone agrees upon, you can't win. Honest Frenchie Gipps, former gambling casino operator in Miami, explains.
Gambling can be beat. That if it was possible to beat gambling, the gamblers will never be in the business. Monte Carlo broke everybody in the world. And America the same way. Every year you must lose. You don't need to be cheated. You must lose against that 16% against you. Frenchie told you before. Don't blame Frenchie you play the game roulette as you can win. There's too many O's in the single O and double O. You can overcome the 2 green ones. French win all the money in the world with 1 O. In this country, we play with 2 O's. How can you win when the percentage is so bad against you?
Any investigation of gambling usually runs into the question of whether it is right or wrong. People who argue for gambling generally justify it if the money goes for a good cause. Herb Grappas, columnist of the Chicago Sun-Times, states the problem for us.
Churches and charitable organizations run illegal gambling because that's the only sure way of getting money for holy causes from people who otherwise wouldn't contribute if the Almighty pushed a 45 right at them. Veterans organizations and fraternal clubs and social clubs have found that the one reliable way of getting money from those who wouldn't otherwise come across is by some gentle gambling. It's gentle, but it's still gambling.
The question of the morality of gambling is something each person must decide with his own conscience. There are arguments advanced on both sides. What there is no argument with is who the people are who control gambling throughout most of the country, and what happens to communities that allow the gambling interest to creep in. Daniel Sullivan is director of the Greater Miami Crime Commission. He can tell you about the boys who ran gambling in his town until they were shut down recently.
In this area here, we had two large groups. One just north of Miami in Broward County, which is the New York mob. That was made up of Meyer the Bug Lansky, his brother Jake Lansky, Joe Adonis, Jimmy Blue Eyes ALO, Frank Erickson, Joe Massey of Detroit, and Lefty Clark. The Chicago Capone Syndicate first got a foothold here in 1949, in the spring of 1949, when they compelled the S&G Syndicate, a local bookmaking syndicate in Miami Beach, to bring the Capone Syndicate in as a partner.
Do you want first-hand proof of the existence of the organized mob, of their methods and their control? We have that proof. We're about to play for you one of the most astonishing recordings ever made. In it, you will hear a murder plotted. You will hear a man referred to as owning an entire state from the police up. You will hear of plans to get a man killed in the state penitentiary. The recording is real. These are not actors. It was made by the alert Dallas, Texas Police Department, headed by Chief Carl Hansen. The story, briefly, is this. Benny Binion, the kingpin of Dallas gambling rackets, was feuding with Herbert Noble, a gambler. A total of 11 attempts were made on Noble's life. Noble was shot several times. Somehow, he survived. In one attempt, Herbert Noble's wife stepped on the starter of their car and was blown up. A charge of dynamite had been planted there. Well, the big mob didn't like this. The feud was bringing unfavorable publicity. More than that, the syndicate could not operate in Dallas as long as it was not safe for their man, Benny Binion, to be there. So the big boys decided that Herbert Noble and Benny Binion must make up. They sent an emissary, Hal Shimley, to Dallas to try to get Noble and Binion together. In a brilliant bit of detective work, the Dallas police got wind of this, and Lieutenant George Butler managed to hide a microphone in the tourist cabin where the conversation took place. You are about to hear what he recorded, except for the curse words, which we have cut out. Here is the actual conversation of emissary Hal Shimley and gambler Herbert Noble in a Dallas tourist cabin. Shimley speaks first. He tries to convince Noble that Binion had nothing to do with Mrs. Noble's murder. He tells Noble who sent him.
The whole damn thing can be straightened out and can be straightened out, and I know what I'm talking about. Now, I've meet up with some people out there that own this big hotel. That Eastern outfit that owns that joint. The man's got the sheriff, the police, the judges. He's got everything in the state through that outfit that owns everything on.
Shimley says Benny Binion swears that he had nothing to do with Mildred Noble's murder.
On top of this, when we get talking about it, he sits down at the table, me, him, and Dave, and two other people. He says, I hope my five children will die this minute and hold his hand up like this if I know one thing on earth about it. So Benny said that himself. And he says, I'm going to get to the bottom of the whole damn thing, and I've got people working on it now. So that was my mission here, was to try to get you two to talk together over the telephone and let me and Philip go out there and Philip straighten the whole damn thing out. And he's got to get in the middle of it because he's your friend and he can't do any more and I can't do it by myself. Now, I'm telling you what the man said. Would you talk to the man over the phone?
Yeah.
Get him on the damn phone right now.
Okay.
Give me long distance, please. Yes, I want 3669W, Las Vegas, Nevada. Hello? Miss Binion? Is Miss Binion there? This is Shimley. Hello? This is Hal Shimley. Hal Shimley? Yes? I'd like to talk to him, please, if you can get him on the phone. Hello, Benny? This is Shimley. Well, I'm in Dallas, and I thought what I told you I thought I could do. And I think this whole thing can be straightened out 100%. And, of course, I know what I've told, and you know the whole score from start to finish. I know you wouldn't have spent the $10,000 if you hadn't known. And I don't get that from you, I get it from the other people. Now do I have, just like you said when I left town, the power to go ahead and try to straighten the whole thing out? Well, that'll precaution will be taken. Well, no, you won't be responsible, but still them other people, we've got to take care of that. So, then I'll get right on it, and me and Phillip will probably see you within the next 2 or 3 days anyhow, maybe tomorrow. All right, then, you be good, and we'll see you soon. All right.
Shinway tells Noble that the gang knows who killed his wife.
How am I going to know who killed my wife? You know about that when you find them out here. You know who the son was that was one of them.
Too.
Why, you know.
No, well, yes, sir. We're talking plain and we're...
Well, only the other thousand.
Who else, sir?
They know where they bought the dynamite. In a way, done hope down back now.
Shimley makes a deal. If the gang settles up accounts with Mildred Noble's murderers, will Noble be friends with Binion and the gang?
If we can get this thing straightened out and settle that thing off with him, will you be friends enough with the man that we can all make money and open the town?
Yeah.
Shimley says Mildred Noble's murderers were amateurs. The mob would not have been so clumsy.
I do honestly believe this, that if that man had wanted to have anything done to you, that he could have had it. People that don't do a thing but that, you understand what I mean? He didn't have to go, the man has that kind of connection, he wouldn't have to go to something that would be an amateur way stuff that's on you, and the way they went along, the way they've gone about it.
I never said it was.
But Noble doesn't know about all this. He doesn't want to be thought yellow, but also the man Shimley says is his wife's murderer is now in the penitentiary.
Well, I'll tell you, there ain't nothing I'd rather do than to get it squared, but I'm not
showing
no
yellowness. Oh, now, there ain't nobody even thought about that further. You understand? The idea is that this thing here, don't you think it can be taken care of, Philip?
I always hope it
could. You do your part, don't you? Yeah. And I damn sure do mine. That's their business, and nothing else. They don't make no mistakes. The man has already told me. He says, if we can get all this stuff taken off me and let it lay where it is, he says, I'll take care of the whole situation. He says, I can get the son killed in the penitentiary.
He can get the man killed in the penitentiary. Well, the man in the penitentiary is still alive, but Herbert Noble is not. On August the 7th, a week and a half after the first broadcast of this program, Herbert Noble was blown to bits by dynamite in front of his home near Dallas. The 12th try on his life was successful. The murderers have not yet been apprehended. If ever a first-hand proof were needed of the methods and interstate nature of organized crime, you've just heard it. These are the people who advance the idea that gambling is good for business. Mayor Shep Morrison of New Orleans knows better.
The records of our city and the history of the past 5 years will give you a totally different story. Tourist trade has never been better. The new policy of law enforcement and the policy of business administration has paid us our greatest dividend. New Orleans has had to make its choice, ladies and gentlemen, between the city of old with its wide open gambling dens or the city of the future, an industrial and transportation center with a much better and a higher standard of living. Thank heavens we have chosen the latter course, and our 600,000 people are far better off because of it.
The gamblers are on the run in some sections of the country. They're still operating wide open in violation of the law in many others. The price we pay is fantastic. The best estimate of the illegal gambling take in this country is between $17 and $30 billion annually. That estimate was made by Senator Kefauver. Where the heat is on, the gamblers lay low. One of the more frank slot machine manufacturers told us,
I believe in letting sleeping dogs lie. My daddy started in this business 62 years ago, And he always told me, play the shell game. Collect a few nickels. Move along. But don't talk about it. If I say nothing, I can't say right or wrong. While the heat's on, I don't say nothing. You know, it's just like when your wife is mad. Shut up until she cools off.
The vicious pattern of gambling in the United States adds up to this. Gambling cannot operate without the knowledge or connivance of public officials. Gambling means corruption. Gambling gives the illusion of something for nothing. Actually, it takes from the poor and channels that money into the hands of the gangsters. The fantastic gambling take is then used to enlarge the power of the organized criminals, to spread out into other rackets, to buy and corrupt more public officials, to undermine the structure of honest government. The basic question is not whether gambling is right or wrong, but who controls it and what happens to the money. There is no evidence that legalized gambling removes the control of the mobsters. On the contrary, it gives them the aura of respectability. The cancer of gambling, with its necessary counterpart of political corruption, is growing before your eyes. It is only necessary that you wake up and see it. It's a big problem, part of the nation's nightmare. But it's your problem, and you can do something about it. Former Governor Luther Youngdahl of Minnesota, now a federal judge, cleaned up his state through the passage of a single law. That can happen in your state, too, if you want it.
We drove the gamblers out of Minnesota by aiming our law at the places where gamblers operate. Our law provides for cancellation of the business licenses, which permit a tavern or other place of business to operate if slot machines or other gambling devices are found on the premises. It was just as simple as that, and it has been entirely effective because it has been enforced without fear or favor. If you want to solve a gambling problem in your state, remember that crime cannot exist in the face of strong laws rigidly enforced. It is not enough to get rid of some of the gamblers or some of the rackets. The whole rotten core must be cut out if the community and the state and the government are to be as safe and as free and as incorruptible as we want them to be. It is entirely up to the people. If they want gambling, no law will stop it. If they want safe cities and safe government, then they must support the fight against gamblers and all forms of organized crime.
Do you want clean cities, or do you want this? It's up to you.
The man got the sheriff, the police, the judges. He's got everything in the state through that outfit that owns everything now. That's their business, and nothing else. They don't make no mistakes. The man has already told me. He says, if we can get all this stuff taken off me and let it lay where it is, he says, I'll take care of the whole situation. He says, I can get to some hill in the penitentiary.
You have just heard a rebroadcast of The Nation's Nightmare, narrated by CBS newsman Bill Downs, the second in a special series of documentaries on the pattern of organized crime in America.